Welcome to the Bone Coach Show, dedicated to helping you understand all things related to diet, lifestyle, bone health, and how you can live and thrive with low bone density and osteoporosis. I'm your host, Kevin Ellis, certified health coach, health and wellness speaker, and above all else, your bone coach. After being diagnosed with osteoporosis in my early 30s, I transformed my health through diet and lifestyle and now help my clients and community members do the same through my online coaching practice, BoneCoach.com. Look, there are no quick and easy cures for low bone density, but the choices we make every single day can have a powerful impact on our bones, our health, and our general well-being. I'll share the research, interview the experts, and help you figure out how to get the conditions right in your body so you can better your bones through diet and lifestyle. A short disclaimer, I'm not a medical doctor, and this show should not be considered medical advice. Always consult with your healthcare team before making medical decisions and changes to your diet and lifestyle. With that being said, let's get on to the show. Welcome to this episode of the Bone Coach Podcast. Today, I'm really excited because I'm interviewing Dr. Laura John Gregorio. She's a PhD researcher at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, and she's done extensive work with Osteoporosis Canada, Bone Fit, Too Fit to Fracture, and her focus is exercise physiology and how it relates to osteoporosis. So today, we're going to talk about reducing the fracture risk while actually doing exercises. We're going to talk about what builds bone. You know, she and her research team conduct different research studies and clinical trials and things like that. I think you're going to learn so much in this episode. Before we get to the episode, I want to encourage you, if you haven't done so already, pause this episode right now, head over to bonecoach.com, sign up for the free 7-day osteoporosis kickstart, and that's going to tell you and walk you through everything you need to be doing right now to take charge of your bone health. So if you haven't done so already, pause this episode, head over to bonecoach.com, do that, and we'll be here right when you get back. With that being said, let's get on with the show. So our guest today is Laura John Gregorio, PhD. She's a researcher at the Department of Kinesiology at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. She teaches and educates people on the topics of exercise physiology, physical activity and aging, osteoporosis, bone health, and quite simply, using exercise as medicine as we age. And the focus of her research team is to reduce the burden of osteoporotic fractures. They use medical imaging technologies to explore bone and muscle responses. They conduct epidemiologic studies to inform fracture risk assessment algorithms. Her team conducts clinical trials to investigate the effects of exercise interventions for reducing fracture risk in high-risk individuals. Laura and her team have also worked with Osteoporosis Canada to develop Bone Fit, which is a 2-day workshop for learning about proper exercise prescription for individuals with osteoporosis. And they also led the development of the Too Fit to Fracture exercise and physical activity recommendations for people with osteoporosis. It is an absolute honor to have you on the show, Laura. Thanks for coming.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's going to be fun.
Yeah, no, I'm excited. So I wanted to start by asking you, how did you get started with a career in kinesiology and how did that evolve into being a research chair in mobility and aging and working with people with osteoporosis to prevent fracture?
That's a really good question. I started in high school really being interested in health, and I ended up in kinesiology. It was my cross-country coach that suggested it would be a good option, although I wasn't a very good cross-country runner at the time. I just tried a lot of different things when I was in my undergrad degree in kinesiology. And what really, I actually found it really fun when I was doing my honors thesis to go to the library and, read articles and think about them and critically evaluate them and then get to write a paper. I actually found that was fun, which is, I know sounds really geeky, but I enjoyed it a lot more than a lot of the other kind of kinesiology experiences that I had. And so my supervisor suggested that I do a master's, and that's kind of how I ended up in grad school. And then a lot of it for me was the mentors that I met along the way. My cross-country coach advised me to go to kinesiology, and then my supervisor suggested research, and then, I had a PhD advisor suggest, that I could move on to a PhD. And, it's really the people that were around me that kind of guided me towards the career I have. So I guess I'm very thankful that I met the right people.
That's great. And specifically working with people with osteoporosis to prevent fracture, which is, that's for this population, that's probably the biggest concern that there is.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is that I was actually interested in cardiac rehab when I started grad school. And I was working with Neil McCartney, who was kind of one of the Canadian leaders in cardiac rehab research at the time. And he had gotten a grant to do research on bone health in people with spinal cord injury. And so that ended up being my thesis. And through that process, I got to seek out other researchers who did research in bone health. And that sort of, I realized that, you know, there was lots of evidence around the effects of exercise on cardiovascular outcomes, and but the research on exercise in people with osteoporosis wasn't as well defined. And I just saw an opportunity to do better research, or to work with others also to do better research. So, yeah.
And how important is exercise for bone health?
It's very important, and it's important throughout the lifespan. And I think that's the we often don't think about when we're young about, you know, bone health. You know, people think about, you know, getting kids active just for this, the health benefits, but they don't really think about the types of activities that are important for bone health. And so we want exercise that involves, you know, that's dynamic, that involves impact, that challenges our muscles to grow. So that, because you have kind of two different types of stimuli, right? You have muscle pulling on bone, and then you also have the impact where you're like actually kind of having impact with the ground or with some other surface, right? So those are both the types of things that have been studied and seem to be, like when you see the types of interventions that are effective, they often use one or both in combination. But there's research in kids to suggest that physical activity may have an impact on bone. And then as we get older, there is more and more research suggesting that we need to do strength training and impact training to try to stimulate and maintain bone. What I found really interesting, you know, in grad school was reading some of the studies that were done many years ago, but looking at different sports teams and how, you know, playing different sports affects your bone. And they, for example, they would take tennis players. And the neat thing about tennis is that you primarily use one hand to play. So they can actually compare the bones of tennis players, compare their playing arm to their non-playing arm. And they can actually look at the effect of the loading of the, like the tennis ball hitting the racket or the forces of their arm on bones. And there's big differences in bone structure and the amount of bone mass people have when they compare their playing and non-playing arm, which is really fascinating. And so you can see, kind of look at the different types of sports and see how they affect people's bone health.
Yeah, that really is interesting. You know, if you're more dominant in one hand, like your right hand, you might have higher bone density in that hand, right?
I think it depends on if that hand is actually experiencing more loading, right? So in a tennis player, the difference in loading between their dominant and non-dominant hand would be huge, because they're constantly, you know, the ball's hitting the racket and that vibration is traveling up their arm, or their muscle forces to grip the racket and generate forces would be very high compared to their non-dominant arm. Whereas in a person who doesn't play tennis and is just, you know, a regular average person, might not necessarily have the side-to-side differences. I imagine there might be some differences though. I can't recall a study off the top of my head that looked at that. But
so when someone is developing an exercise program for themselves, so specifically somebody with osteoporosis, what are the different types of exercise that they can incorporate, and why would it be really important to be intentional and specific about how you're actually putting your own plan together?
Yeah, so I would say that I don't think the exercise program that a person with osteoporosis would do is that different than one that someone that doesn't have osteoporosis would do. I think the only difference is, for me anyway, is that someone who has osteoporosis probably needs to be mindful of the activities that can increase the risk of fracture. So things like, so we always say, like, so people will say, well, don't bend and don't twist. And it's not like all bending and twisting is bad. It's kind of hard to move around without bending or twisting at all. You do want some movement in your spine. But we think about the types of movements that are riskier, things like forward flexion when it's rapid, repetitive, weighted, or sustained, or when it's combined with twisting, and similarly with twisting when it's rapid, repetitive, weighted, or sustained. So, you know, for example, like you'll see people doing those like exercises where they do like a V-sit and they hold a kettlebell and they twist back and forth. In that exercise, you would have compression from sitting, and then you have also the fact that you're kind of sitting in a flexed position to use your abs, and then you're also twisting and you're adding a weight, right? So for me, I would never recommend an exercise like that for someone with osteoporosis. There's lots of other ways to target your core. And so it's often more like what we want, how we might want to modify or think about the exercise. It's not necessarily that it would be different. I would say in general, for most adults and for most older adults, you know, what our guidelines recommend and that it, you know, you want to do things that get your heart pumping, right? And that's to keep your heart healthy. And I guess the difference I would say is someone with osteoporosis would still want to do those things, but they might want to think about having some of those activities involve impact. Right? Whether it's like doing, and again, it depends on the person's level of risk. So for example, if someone was high risk, I wouldn't say go out and start jumping. But if it was a kid or an adult who didn't have low bone mass, I would say, you know, maybe incorporating some jumping movements would be good for stimulating bone, right? We usually want to condition muscles first before we start jumping exercises. But the idea of like having some higher impact activities is as part of your kind of aerobic physical activity for your health is helpful. And then we want to do resistance training at least twice a week to challenge muscles and have muscle pull on bone to prevent muscle loss with aging, to keep us strong so we can get out of chairs and get off the floor and push door, heavy doors and that sort of thing. And then we also want to do activities that challenge our balance. And again, I would recommend that for everyone, not just people with osteoporosis. I think with osteoporosis, you're more concerned about your balance because a lot of fractures happen due to falls. You might be more concerned about muscle because, you know, again, the muscle pulling on bone, people who with osteoporosis tend to be over 50 or over 65, so they may have lost muscle already. The impact piece is interesting. We want to encourage impact, but impact is hard to introduce in people who've never done it before. So usually we start with a graded approach where we start with lower impact activities, maybe do some strength training to condition the muscles and then progress the impact activity over time. But I mean, this is all consistent with our national physical activity guidelines for adults in general, or for older adults. So I wouldn't necessarily say that the recommended activities are different.
So what is the actual interplay between muscle and bone? You know, you're saying that muscle pulls on bone. What actually takes place that induces some kind of structural adaptation for bone to get stronger?
So, you know, the muscle is pulling on bone and that may cause bending in the bone or may cause stress at the attachment site of the bone, right? So if you think about when you're actually having muscles pull on bone, they're kind of like levers, right? So they're pulling on bone, they're creating sort of bending forces and they're also pulling at the attachment site. And that is sort of a mechanical signal. And then that is often maybe sensed by cells that are in bone. And those cells will then convert that mechanical signal into a chemical signal. And that chemical signal then will cause things to happen that might either slow down bone breakdown or increase osteoblast activity to actually increase the building of bone relative to bone breakdown. And I think their cells' ability to sense those signals and have that chemical signal happen can, some research suggests that it is affected by hormonal status and it's affected by age and other things. So that's why it may be harder to change bone when we're older or when we're postmenopausal than it is when we're younger. And that's why we often encourage people to do physical activity when they're younger so that they kind of build an optimal bone mass.
And are there specific types of exercise that can that are most effective for building bone?
Yeah, so most of the research points to either resistance training activities or dynamic short bouts of impact activity. So I always like to kind of think of, again, back to the sports that are effective. Like if you think about like soccer players often have really good leg bone density. And you think about the fact that they're often like kind of quickly changing direction and having to move quickly. So they're generating powerful forces as they move, but it's short lived. It's not like a long distance runner where it's the same load over and over and over again for a long period of time. And in fact, long distance runners sometimes have really low bone density, as do swimmers, because they're not having that, swimmers don't have that same impact, right? So I'll point back to, you know, combining impact exercise with resistance training. And resistance training where we're actually challenging our muscles with moderate or high effort, right? So it's actually quite difficult. So you can do a resistance training exercise like a wall push-up, but if it's really easy for you, then it's probably not doing very much. So you need to make sure that you're choosing a version of the exercise that's actually challenging for you.
And what, is there a specific range, like rep range, that we're looking for, a specific percentage of like our maximum effort that we should be putting into these to actually make sure we're building bone or building muscle and, you know, in turn bone?
That's a really good question. And it's something that, again, if I'm talking just about people with osteoporosis, it's really hard to find solid evidence to say for sure that there's one, you know, intensity and one rep range that you must do. I will say that when you look at the studies that seem to show changes in bone, they tend to be on the higher intensity side. So they tend to have lower rep ranges and they're more challenging. But the problem with that is that most people who are starting resistance training shouldn't start there, right? They should probably start with learning good form and being able to execute the exercise with no weights or very little weight with good form and really practice that and then slowly increase the weight over time. So that would be the first step, is before even saying we should be at this intensity, is can you actually do the exercise safely? Because if you can't do it safely, then you're going to hurt yourself.
Yeah.
But then once we get to that safe place, some research, there's been some studies that suggest you should be doing really high intensity, like no more than 5 repetitions. So a weight that you maybe can only lift 6 or 7 times, and you do 5 repetitions of that. So you're almost at, you know, like your max when you're finishing your set. But I don't know necessarily that there's convincing evidence that if you match volume or effort, that you can't do lighter weight. So that's something that I think we still need to understand. So could I pick a weight that was a little bit lighter, but really push myself and get to 10 repetitions so that the level of effort is the same, but maybe the load isn't as high? Because I think from a acceptability or feasibility perspective, I think it would be a lot easier to introduce resistance training if you didn't have to have people lifting really, really heavy weight. Because when you have people lifting really heavy weight, you have to have a lot of supervision. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of studies comparing different intensities. So we see like some studies will use, the studies that tend to show an effect tend to be on the higher end. So I would say, 8 to 10 repetitions maximum, or even lower at 6 repetitions maximum or 5 repetitions maximum, which meaning like, they're doing a weight where they can only lift the weight 8 or 10 times, or 6 times is 6 repetitions maximum, right? So the intensities tend to be on the higher end. But that said, we need to train people to get there.
Yeah. Cause a lot, I mean, people aren't necessarily, I started out with a background in weightlifting when I was in high school. So I kind of have good foundation for building on that now. But if you didn't have that foundation when you were younger and you've never really lifted weights before, it's probably not a good idea to just jump right in and start lifting, you know, really, really heavy and throwing weights around, because that could lead to injury.
That's right. Yeah. So we usually want to train people in the fundamental movement patterns and then slowly over time build their intensity. And that also maybe builds self-efficacy, where you feel confident that you can do it. If I was to take someone who's never been into the weight room and said, you're going to go to that squat rack and, you know, lift the Olympic bar, it's probably pretty intimidating.
Yeah. I was just going to say intimidating. Yeah.
So I guess what I would say to, if I was speaking with people with osteoporosis, I would say, where are you at now in terms of your, ability to do resistance training, your desire, your how you feel about it? And let's start with that. But we want to progress you eventually to a level where you're doing fundamental strength exercises and an intensity that's really challenging for you. And ideally that you're doing less than 10 or less repetitions in a given set. So that's probably what I would say, but I wouldn't necessarily say to start there.
Yeah. So, and you've been talking, for about 6 reps, 8 reps, 10 reps. We're not talking about, 20 repetitions, like getting a really light weight and lifting it multiple times, 20, 30 times, because that's really not going to have an effect, correct?
Well, I certainly haven't seen studies that have convinced me that it's effective. Unfortunately, the studies that are out there are limited. Of the studies I've looked at lighter intensity resistance training, they seem to suggest that it doesn't really have an effect. The problem is that a lot of those studies don't specifically recruit people with osteoporosis. So they'll recruit healthy postmenopausal women rather than recruiting people with osteoporosis. So, you know, but all the more reason I would say to kind of go with, because I would expect that the effect would be less in people with osteoporosis than it would be in people who are have healthier bones, because, you know, they have less bone, they have less bone cells, they might be less responsive, right? So they might be on bone medication, which then makes them even less responsive. So I would probably say that we still want to try to challenge people.
You know, a lot of times there will be lower bone density in like the lumbar spine, for example, with L4 usually being really low than compared to other areas in the body, like the hip and the forearm. Yeah. Can you target specific areas of your body to build bone, or does bone building occur universally throughout your body, no matter which exercise you use?
I would say I don't know necessarily that I have, you know, clinical trials that would, you know, convincingly say that if I do X exercise, I can target my hip. But I will say that it seems that bone is, you know, site specific in terms of its response. So for example, there was a study done in Australia, and they did heavy resistance training in people with low bone mass. And the largest response they saw was at the spine. And that makes sense to me, because if you think about it, when you're lifting heavy weight, you have to really engage your core. A lot of them were multi-joint movements like squats and overhead presses and deadlifts, which are really going to engage the core. And as well, you're putting weight on your back when you're doing a squat, right? When you're doing an overhead press, you're lifting overhead. That's a lot of axial loading. So to me, that makes a lot of sense that you're going to have a much larger response in the spine. The other thing is the spine has much more trabecular bone, which is much more metabolically active. So you're going to probably see a change there first. The femoral neck, which is where people often fracture their hip, unfortunately doesn't have any muscle attachments, right? So the muscles attach all around, but don't actually attach onto the femoral neck, right? So, you know, you don't have, you know, as much, I think a lot harder to target the femoral neck specifically, and therefore harder to see changes there. But maybe you might see changes in other areas around the hip. It's not to say that you shouldn't still do exercises, because even that study showed a small between group difference in that the exercise group had slightly better hip bone density than the control group, but it was a much, much, much smaller difference. So you do see differences at different sites. You know, is there a magical exercise for targeting the hip? Probably not. I would say probably if that's another good reason to combine impact loading with resistance training, because it might be that maybe in our legs we might have a better response if we're actually doing the impact. But even that study that I mentioned, they were doing impact exercise as well. And again, that might also explain why you see sort of, you know, some impact, some effect on the hip. It's hard to say.
Yeah, I'm just curious too. So the different types of bone, you mentioned trabecular bone more in the spine, cortical bone more in the femoral neck. Impact.
The femoral neck actually has quite a bit of trabecular bone as well. It's just that the highest percentage of so like if you look at the lower parts of the spine are very high in trabecular bone, whereas the femoral neck is also quite high relative to other sites, but the percentage isn't as high. And then if you look at the actual femur, it's, you know, the shaft of the femur, it's pretty much all cortical bone.
Sure. So do impact exercises have more of an effect on specific types of bone than resistance exercise?
I think that's hard to say, because it's not like you have clinical trials that will sort of randomize people to a specific type of exercise and then look at, you know, this type of bone versus this type of bone versus this type of bone. Usually the randomized trial will have one or more interventions and then look at a bunch of different sites, right? So that's a harder question to answer. I think that what you'll see is changes happen. You'll be able to see changes faster in sites that are rich in trabecular bone. Or if you're actually measuring trabecular and cortical bone separately, which you need a separate type of scanner for, you might be able to see changes in the trabecular bone faster, just because, again, it's more metabolically active. And it might be harder to see the changes in the cortical bone, but we do see with aging that you see changes over time in the shape of our bones and the shape of the cortex. And it's possible that mechanical loading over time may also change that. And so, it, again, if when you looked at the tennis players, they had wider bones, right? So I think that you can see changes in both compartments, but maybe harder to, like in clinical trials, harder to detect differences unless you have a trial that's long enough.
Sure. Now you mentioned the, was it the Lifmore study you were referencing?
I was, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So Lifmore study in Australia that was done a couple years back, and it was incorporating, what was it, squats, deadlifts, overhead presses.
Overhead presses, and impact exercise.
Okay.
Like they had like the what do they call it, drop jumps.
And those were the exercises that, at least in that particular study, that showed, what was the percentage of increase that they showed over what period of time? I can't remember.
Oh, now you're testing my memory. I believe, so, and the other thing that's important to know is that they're going to report a between group difference, meaning that they're going to have what happened in the, what was the bone density in the control group and what was in the exercise group. So my recollection, and I'd have to, I can probably pull it up actually. My recollection was that at the hip, the control group lost bone, and the intervention group had gained, or sorry, was the same or a very small increase. Whereas at the spine, there was an increase in bone in the exercise group and a little bit of loss in the control group. So there was a bit of a difference in how the different sites adapted as well. But in a lot of studies that are looking at exercise, you often see that where the control group is losing bone and the exercise group is kind of maintaining bone. Rather than sort of, you know, large increases in bone due to the exercise.
I know we've been talking about building bone here. Is there a different approach that you take to exercise if your goal is not building bone, if it's just to prevent fracture?
Well, I mean, if you want to prevent fracture, there's two things you can do. You can not fall or not load your vertebrae as too much so that they don't fracture. So you affect the applied load to the bone, or you can increase the bone strength. So there's two things you can do. Try to increase bone strength or try to reduce the applied loads, or both. So if you want to reduce the applied loads, the majority of fractures occur as a result of a fall. So you just have to do things to prevent falls. So that's things like balance and functional training would be a good example, or Tai Chi, where you're actually working on challenging balance to improve your balance so that you're better able to respond to perturbations. And vertebral fractures often occur either as a result of a fall or as a result of a movement that applies compression or torsional forces to the vertebrae. So you have to do things to try to avoid applying those forces. So in someone who's really high risk of fracture, the doctor will tell them, don't bend and don't twist. And it's because they're trying to have them avoid applying those loads to the vertebrae. Now, I don't necessarily think all people should avoid all bending and all twisting. It's about learning how to, you know, support your spine and modify activities so that you avoid the riskiest types of bending and twisting. So that's on the applied load side of the equation. And if you think about bone strength, that's where people think of bone density as a kind of surrogate of bone strength. But there's, you know, sort of how much bone you have, and then there's also how that bone is organized. And so with age, we lose the amount of bone we have, and we think that with exercise, we can actually either maintain or slightly increase the amount of bone we have and potentially also affect its structure. Although there's much less data on changes in bone structure than there are changes in bone density. So I just pulled up this study for you, so I'm going to look at it quickly. Okay, so the between group differences in lumbar spine bone mineral density were about 4%. So the control group lost about 1% and the intervention group gained about 3%. That's on average. And then the hip or femoral neck, the control group lost 2% and the exercise group pretty much stayed the same.
And that was over what period of time was that?
That was 8 months.
8 months.
So it just goes to show that, you know, you're not seeing large increases. A lot of it is prevention of loss, maybe a slight increase at the spine. And it's really tricky to interpret lumbar spine bone density data because it actually sometimes tends to increase over time because you get things like arthritis or aortic calcification, and that kind of shows up on x-rays and it looks like bones are stronger when they're really not. So some people their bone, lumbar spine VMD actually sometimes looks like it's increasing when it's not. So I'm always a little wary when I see big changes in lumbar spine bone density over a short period of time. So I would like to see something like this replicated, although they have published subsequent data in men and have shown similar changes. So that's a very encouraging.
So, and sometimes people with osteoporosis have other conditions too. You just mentioned one that serve to complicate developing an exercise plan. So osteoarthritis being one of them, especially in the knees, spinal stenosis, scoliosis, ankylosing spondylitis. How do you work around some of these conditions?
Yeah, that's a really good point, because that study that we were just talking about, you know, that was done, you know, kind of in a lab setting and where they controlled who entered the study. So they actually excluded over 100 people because they had medical conditions that would not allow them to, that wasn't meant it wasn't safe for them to participate. So, you know, that's, you know, when they screened 400 people and they excluded 100, that means 25% of the population that they considered, you know, could not, shouldn't, but weren't eligible for the study just based on medical conditions alone. So you're right. It does pose a problem when you're trying to introduce strength training or impact training. So if someone, for example, has disc problems or osteoarthritis in the knees, they're probably not going to, you know, be too keen to start a jumping program, right? Because it's probably going to be quite painful. So how do we work around that? Well, we have to think about, okay, well, maybe our focus then in those people is going to be the strengthening muscles and not so much the impact, where we're going to try to get them to work towards lower impact activities so that they're getting some impact, but then really focusing on the strength training. Or maybe in some people, like if I had someone who had very severe osteoporosis and maybe also severe hyperkyphosis, I'm probably not going to get them doing deadlifts, right? I might get them doing unweighted exercises like hinging type movements to learn to control their body in that in space, but I might be a bit more hesitant about using a lot of heavy weight, especially with hyperkyphosis where we're now changing, you know, their balance, their center of mass, that sort of thing. But those people might also be at risk of falls, right, because of these changes. And so maybe my best bet in that group is to really focus on fall prevention and say, okay, well, we're going to really work on, stabilizing your spine, working on your posture, working on your core control, working on your ability to respond to perturbation, working on your balance so that we try to prevent the applied loads to your spine or try to prevent falls. Maybe that's our priority, at least initially. And again, you can always start to introduce other types of things if you think it's safe. This is where as the risk increases, I think the need for advice from an exercise physiologist increases, where you need to someone who knows, okay, we're not going to start you with, you know, heavy deadlifts. We're going to slowly, you know, progress to you. Start with your balance exercises and select a goal that's relevant for you.
Yeah, no, that's something I always recommend is even just a baseline. Hey, before you go develop an exercise program, don't just go on YouTube and start throwing things together on your own.
Yeah.
Go meet with somebody at least one time. Let them look at your body mechanics. Let them figure some of these things out for you, or let them point out things that you may not be aware of that could possibly lead to injury when you start working out.
Mm-hmm. And I, you know, in when it's someone who has osteoporosis, it's even picking an exercise physiologist who has knowledge of osteoporosis, who knows how to modify exercise for someone who has osteoporosis. I think that's really, really important because, you know, I've met lots of people who are very, very skilled exercise physiologists, but don't really understand, you know, the risks and what types of exercises and movements are risky. We actually worked with Osteoporosis Canada on a training program for exercise physiologists and physios called Bone Fit, where we actually do a weekend course on what is osteoporosis and what is risky and what are the types of things we want to focus on in this group, just to give people some background knowledge, because it's not something that's always taught in, you know, undergrad degrees or physio school.
Sure. Could you actually talk about Bone Fit a little bit more about, you know, what are some of the things that are being taught in that course to the people that we should be seeking out if we're going to look for somebody that can help us with this?
Well, so we talk, it's very comprehensive. So it has this, like, it's a comprehensive binder of materials, and then you have to do a test kind of coming into the workshop. And it's a 2-day workshop for exercise physiologists and physical therapists, but there's also a one-day workshop for exercise instructors. So someone who's, say, a yoga instructor would just get the basics of, okay, how do you, what are the things that increase the risk of fracture? So what could you ask your client? Like, for example, you could ask them, have they had a fracture before? Right? Because that's going to mean they're at increased risk. You know, are they on medication? Do they have rheumatoid arthritis, or, you know, have they taken steroid medications that, you know, increase your risk? So having them sort of be able to understand a basic risk assessment, understand the basics of the types of movements that we tend to be concerned about. So one is anything that increases fall risk. So when we think about yoga, for example, I think about, okay, tree pose. I fall over when I do tree pose every single time because I cannot keep my foot in that weird position. And so, you know, if I was someone with osteoporosis, I'd want to be doing tree pose next to a wall, right? So that I have something to hold on to. It's the basics, right? So thinking about what are the things that are going to make me fall, make sure I have a support object, or make sure I have a different version of that exercise so that I don't put myself at risk of falling. The other types of movements we think about are things that are going to increase the risk of spine fracture. So as I mentioned, anything that puts our spine in flexion or forward bending or crunching our spines, even, you know, when you sit and watch TV, you kind of sit in a crunched position because your spine is flexed, right? So sitting up straight. So any yoga posture, you have to look at alignment. And I use yoga a lot because it's a good example of where there's lots of really healthy movements and lots of really unhealthy movements for the spine, right? So when it comes to osteoporosis. So thinking about, or even like if I think about weight training, right? If I am doing overhead shoulder presses, right? I'm putting a lot of weight over my head and that's placing an axial load on my spine. So if my spine is very, very low bone density and I'm not used to that type of load, that could cause a fracture, right? Lifting heavy things overhead. And now if I do a seated overhead press where I sit in a chair and then lift dumbbells over my head, now I'm sitting slightly flexed and lifting weight overhead, right? So that can be risky because we're combining flexion with this weighted overhead thing. So it's teaching people about, you know, the fact that we want to modify movements that are in, flex the spine in a rapid, repetitive, weighted, sustained, or end range way, or do twisting that is rapid, repetitive, weighted, sustained, or end range. So by end range, I mean the end of the range of motion. So I'll give you a good example of that. If we think about when we go to tie our shoes, right? If you bend all the way over, to tie your shoes, so your spine is completely flexed over. Or if we think about a yoga posture, where the one where you kind of do the forward fold, you're bending to the end of your range of motion, right? Hanging off the ligaments of your spine, essentially. Mm. That's the type of movement I would avoid if I was someone with osteoporosis. So if I was tying my shoes, I would sit on a nice bench and I would put my foot up on something and I would bend with a nice hip hinge and tie my shoes, as opposed to bending all the way forward. Is that a good example?
Absolutely, yeah. No, because that's something that people do every day. So
yeah. Yeah, so we teach, you know, the types of movements that are risky, and then we also teach the types of movements we want to encourage. And there's a, in BoneFit, the one thing that I would say is probably really different is there's a lot of focus on spine biomechanics and about working on posture, because that's often a concern we hear from people with osteoporosis. If they develop spine fractures or curvatures of the spine, they want to work on spine, on posture. And so we want to really focus on back extensor muscles. And arguably, I think we're going to have a huge problem moving forward with weak back extensor muscles, because you see people playing video games and sitting on their phone in this kind of hunched position. And I think you're going to have an epidemic of weak back extensor muscles. I encourage, again, not different, I would say the same to everybody in the population, but people with osteoporosis, we often target exercises for back extensor muscles and for core, primarily because we want to keep the spine stable, because if we can have muscles support our spine, then we may be less likely to move funny in a twisty or flexy position to actually cause a fracture, right? That's the scientific term, twisty or flexy.
No, it is scientific. I was just reading that. And what yeah. Medical journal was that?
Medical journals. They always use twisty or flexy.
Yeah. And then you also do work with Osteoporosis Canada, which I do want to talk about that for a minute. So what kind of work have you done with Osteoporosis Canada, and how is that available for, you know, the general public?
Well, that is a great question. So So the Bone Fit development was done by Judy Laprade, but I did consult on that, and that was with Osteoporosis Canada. So that's sort of to educate providers. And then we've done some work called Too Fit to Fracture, which is to educate people with osteoporosis. And so what we did was we developed exercise guidelines that, you know, around sort of safe movement and what types of exercise are recommended and what do we do about yoga and ab exercises and all those things. And then, so we did the scientific work to come up with recommendations. And then we worked with Osteoporosis Canada on materials for people with osteoporosis. So we have videos, we have a booklet, we have a one-pager. And the one-pager was actually designed for physicians, because every time we interviewed physicians around what they needed to get research into practice, they said, just give me a one-pager that I can hand out to my patient, point to a few things that has a link to more information, because I don't have time to tell them anything else, and I don't know anything about exercise. I don't want to talk about it.
Sure, I get that.
So we have this one-pager that has like a hotline and a link and, you know, a bunch of information. And so, and it's available in English, French, Spanish, Mandarin, and Chinese, I think. So it's great because they can download it and use it with people with different languages. Or we did a video series where, and one of the things I heard a lot was, you know, what's the exercise program that everybody for osteoporosis, can you just like do a video? And I said, I can't do that because everybody starts in a different place. Everyone has different goals. There's no one exercise program. It depends on kind of what the person's goals are, what their risk is, what they like to do, right? Because people have different preferences. And so we actually did some interviews with people with osteoporosis and sort of based a video series on that. So we had one video of one, and they were all based on real stories that I heard from people. So for example, I would run into younger women, so women in their 40s and 50s, and even early 60s, you know, saying, you know, like, I feel really young, I feel fit. They tell me I have low bone mass, but like, I feel like I should still be able to do the things I want to do. And they're really frustrated. And so the idea was to create a video of a younger person so that you're not having this stereotypic, because when you Google image of woman with osteoporosis, you see this like gray haired lady with a walker and a cane, like hunched over. I mean, and that's not what osteoporosis is, right? It happens to young people, it happens to old people, it happens to men, it happens to women, right? So, right? So the idea of, you know, having, so a young woman saying, hey, I have osteoporosis, and why is this happening to me, and what can I do? So we told her story, and then we had two videos following showing exercises that she could do. And then we had another woman, a video of a South Asian woman who was like, I'm not going to a gym. You know, that's not like people in my culture. We don't do that. You know, we go out for walks, we socialize. And I'm not trying to generalize about that culture. This is, these were the words that came from her. So I just respected her vision. Right. So, but the idea of, you know, that, you know, there are preferences that may be due to gender or culture or other things that, you know, may influence the way we view exercise. So, you know, her video was completely different, told a different story. We had another video of a man with osteoporosis saying, I thought this was a woman's disease. What is, why is this happening to me? And I want to golf and my doctor tells me I can't. And so then we talked about how do you do the activities you love to do? And, you know, that sort of thing. So each video kind of tells a story, but then it demonstrates either exercises or safe movement. And so I found that work really rewarding because it helped me kind of understand the types of questions that patients have. And we really should be doing research that is guided by what patients want to know, not just kind of what is fun to do in my lab, you know?
So
that was really fun. And we've just restarted kind of that process. I've been working with Osteoporosis Canada over the last 2 years on a new guideline. So that's hopefully going to be released by the end of this year, although this COVID-19 scenario may delay it a little bit. So we're working on new exercise guidelines, and we're taking a slightly different approach this time. What we're going to do is sort of answer 6 questions. So like, should we recommend walking? Should we recommend resistance training? Should we recommend balance training? Should we recommend yoga, et cetera? Just to highlight, because what we get is, what is the evidence around yoga? So now we're going to be able to say, this is what we know, and this is what we would recommend, right? And so it helps us kind of better answer the questions that patients have. And then hopefully we'll be able to do a few more materials like we did last time. I don't think the budget will be as big this time, but so we may not be able to do as many, but hopefully we can do a few, which I'm really
You'll be creative.
I hope so. Yeah. Last time we were really fortunate. We were able to get a government grant to develop out all those materials and do all the background work that are required to interview patients and do all that stuff. This time I'm not sure we'll have the same budget, but hopefully we'll be able to do some more fun stuff. And then we actually have a few clinical trials ongoing that will, one in particular that will look at strength training in people with low bone mass. So similar to the LIFT-MORE trial, but a slightly different research question. So building on that. That hopefully will start in the next year or so, and it'll take a few years to get it done. So look for it in 5 years.
Yeah. That,
no, takes that's, a long time. Yeah.
That's great. Well, so, that's amazing. The work that you've been able to do with both the Two-Fit to Fracture and with Osteoporosis Canada. A couple other questions. So, okay. So we talked about LIFT-MORE, LIFT-MORE trial. And how deadlifts,
which is great work, by the way. I don't want to sound like I'm saying it's not good work. I think when I was implying that it was small changes or that, you know, these things, but the idea that, you know, they've sort of taken that work and said, you know, let's challenge, everyone says people shouldn't lift stuff, and really, like, let's challenge that notion. There are, you know, certainly people with osteoporosis who can progressively learn to resistance training to the point where they can lift heavy things. Not all people will be able to do that. I think it's really great work to show that, you know, some people can. And so we shouldn't sort of presume all people with osteoporosis can't lift things.
Sure. And also, you know, the goal of exercise, it goes back to, what are your goals for exercise? You might not just be trying to build bone. Maybe building bone is not something you can do because of certain conditions or fractures, things like that. Maybe it's, I just want to be healthy. I just want to go, you know, increase my cardiovascular health or do something else or increase my balance, or, you know, your focus can be elsewhere while still improving your health.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, that's where, again, you want to think about the balance between the risk and the benefit, right? So if my goals are primarily around fall prevention, do I need to progress someone to heavy resistance training to achieve that goal? No, right? Will I introduce resistance training? Absolutely, I will. Whereas if someone really is keen to work towards trying to build muscle and bone, then I might move them along that path. But it might be that I have to take a modified approach. So I'll give you a good example. If someone has knee osteoarthritis and shoulder problems, they probably will struggle with the LIFT-MORE program, because the knee OA will cause the impact exercise to be hard. They may not necessarily have the alignment to do some of the exercises at the weight that they need to, like their knee may buckle if they're really lifting heavy or whatever, it may not be safe. And the shoulder issues will impair their ability to kind of hold the bar the same way, or to do an overhead press, right? Shouldn't be doing an overhead press if you don't have good full shoulder range of motion without pain, right? So, and in fact, I think that they actually excluded people who didn't have, you know, who did have those kinds of shoulder problems. And that's very common. Like, I can tell you, when I teach my university students, I have 100 kids in my class, and I tell them to stand up and I tell them to do a full shoulder flexion so that their arm is pointing straight up in the sky. I cannot tell you the number of students who look like this, who cannot, because their pecs are tight, or they sit with rounded shoulders, or I don't know what, or they have shoulder injuries, but they don't have full shoulder range of motion. And if I had someone like that, I wouldn't be giving them full on overhead presses, because I don't want to injure their shoulder because they're lifting weight in a suboptimal angle. But it doesn't mean they can't do shoulder resistance training exercises. It just means I might do kind of a different type of exercise. Like, I might do an incline bench press, which is going to be the same kind of movement, but I'm going to be now lying down instead of standing up, so it's a bit safer, doesn't take me through that shoulder range of motion. So it's thinking about, how do you adapt the exercise for the person's goals and for their impairments, right? So we can still progress exercise. We just have to be a bit more creative.
You were talking about axial load also a minute ago. So where you've got a large load overhead, maybe you're doing a press or something like that. If somebody has a vertebral fracture, or maybe they've had a vertebral fracture and then they got a kyphoplasty, a vertebroplasty, is that contraindicated? Any axial load overhead, or does it?
I would definitely proceed with caution. So I think my approach would be to look at their posture and look at their kind of sort of how they kind of hold themselves and, you know, their ability to like respond to perturbation, like can they engage their core and respond? Like, you know what I mean? Like, so there's lots of things I would look at and how they move. And if it looks to me like they struggle to kind of use their core to stay stable, or if they have some, you know, hyperkyphosis, or they have an exaggerated lumbar lordosis, or maybe no lumbar lordosis, or they have, you know, kind of shoulders kind of curving in, I might really work on those things before I ever do an overhead press, right? And the other thing I would look at is shoulder range of motion. So I would look, you know, can they overhead press? But there's lots of ways to do shoulder exercises without having someone do an overhead press. Right?
Sure, sure.
So I would probably say, you know, I would tell that person if they've had a vertebral fracture and they've got poor posture or hyperkyphosis, and especially if the fracture is painful, I would probably say I would avoid lifting things overhead until I can actually get them to do core exercises, support their spine. Then I might start doing you know, like shoulder flexion exercises, and then maybe I might do like a broomstick press and see how that goes. So it's like still overhead press, but not really weighted. It's quite light. And then work towards getting them to lift like objects, daily objects overhead, like a platter or whatever. And, you know, kind of working towards that before I'm starting to like lift them, have them lift heavy weights, right?
Sure.
But it's thinking about that. Like if you have someone who has a vertebral fracture, has hyperkyphosis or pain, and now they're going on vacation, they have to think, how am I going to get that thing in the overhead bin? They shouldn't be lifting that. So they're going to have to ask for help, or they're going to have to bring something that they can just slip under their chair. And these are important considerations that people don't often think about. An overhead press with weights is the same as lifting your thing into the overhead compartment. And if you've got vertebral fractures, that's a real good way to increase the loads on your spine and put yourself at risk. So especially if you've got poor core stability and you can't stabilize your spine as you go to do that.
I know we're almost out of time here, but I got a couple more questions for you. So any other studies or evidence that shows specific benefits for specific exercises on improving your bone density, like the hopping or specifically jumping and things like that?
Yeah, so there is some evidence that doing impact exercise, whether it's jumping or, you know, certain types of aerobic dance where you're doing impact and stuff, there is evidence that it may improve bone density, may improve other aspects of physical function. So I would definitely combine impact with resistance training if it's appropriate for the person, and if increasing bone density is their goal. Using impact training requires that you, you know, sort of start with low impact and then adapt according to the person's ability and physical fitness. So before you introduce impact, you need to condition muscle. So I would do muscle strengthening first, especially of the calf muscles, etc., to make sure that they have sufficient muscle strength, and then because then I would eventually progress the intensity of impact. And I think they did the same thing in the Lift More trial, where they had them doing heel raises and other types of things before they ever had them doing drop jumps. So it's not like they started people doing drop jumps right away. There was the kind of work in period where they actually trained them to kind of start with low impact and strength training and progress over time.
It wasn't just show up at the gym and, hey, you know, everybody do.
Yeah, jump off this box. Yeah.
No, absolutely not. There was some...
No.
Yeah.
No, they actually did it. They did a really an interesting way of introducing it. So what they did is they had them stand near, like, you know, in a weight room where you can put the Olympic bar on the rack, and they had it kind of up a little bit higher, and they had them stand in front of it, just grab onto it as if they were going to do a chin up, and kind of just imagine to pull themselves up, but they just kind of lifted their heels, right? So they kind of did a heel lift, and then they would drop their heels. So it was kind of like a very gentle impact. And they just kind of progressed them doing that. And then over time, it was kind of like, pull yourself up and then drop, right? So they just sort of progressed the height of the drop over time. But in that time, sort of conditioning them to accept the impact lightly. You know what I mean?
Weighted vests, any evidence?
You know what? I haven't done a specific search to say, what is the evidence on weighted vest? I can tell you that when we search for studies looking at different interventions, it's not often studied. And when it is studied, the quality of the trials are not that great. So I would say that I can't conclusively say that it works or doesn't work.
Sure.
I will say I don't really understand why you would use it. Like, I would use a weighted vest as resistance. So if I was doing a resistance training, let's say I'm doing my home program, and I don't have weights, I might put a weighted vest on to add weight to my squat. That sounds like a great idea, right? If I don't have weights, if I have weights, I just use the weights. But I mean, you know, it's a good way to add weight without having to manipulate weights around you and worry about dropping them on your feet and that kind of stuff. I wouldn't go out walking with a weighted vest. And I'll tell you why. Most of the studies that show, you know, impact exercise and increasing bone, they don't do prolonged impact. So they don't have people doing impact exercise for, you know, half hour, an hour at a time. They're short, quick, high impact loads. So doing a few jumps, right? Again, go back to the soccer player versus runner. Runners don't have high bone density. Same load repeatedly over time. Soccer players, quick, fast movements, and then they're gone, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're going to use impact effectively, you know, so going out for a walk with a weighted vest, I don't think is the answer. I think, you know, doing a few jumps would probably be more effective, but you need to condition yourself to do the jumps first.
Sure. And last question for you about when someone is, you know, first diagnosed, one of the first things they do is they go online and they look, hey, whose work should I follow? Who's reputable? Mm-hmm. Who's credible? Who can I trust to help me kind of gather information? Do you have anyone specifically whose work that you hold in a high regard?
Well, lots of people. And I think it depends on what they're looking for, right?
Sure.
So I think the one thing is that you want to look at materials that are designed for lay people, because sometimes research studies aren't really designed for people to read in a way that is consumable. So for example, a lot of people, I've had patients contact me through Osteoporosis Canada to say, you know, oh, should we be doing the LIFMOR study? And I said, you know, there are lots of people for whom that exercise program would be great, but there are some people for whom it would not be great. And all of those people were excluded from the trial. And a person who's not a researcher wouldn't necessarily pick that out. Right? So they might not know that it may not be appropriate for them, and then they might start it and they might get hurt. So sure. I don't usually encourage, people who are not researchers to seek out research per se, unless they know how to read the research. Don't begrudge them doing it. It's certainly fine for them to do it. And, you know, but I would say that I would usually find a reputable organization that develops patient-facing tools that are evidence-based that then provide information. But even then, when you go and you look for information about osteoporosis, different organizations say different messages. So it's really important. It's really difficult for patients to read that sort of thing. So I would kind of triangulate where I'd look at different organizations and seeing what they're saying. And I would look for the common messages probably. I always lean back Osteoporosis Canada, and I'm biased, but I think they do a really good job of, you know, developing evidence-based messaging. And there's really great scientists who develop the tools and the messaging and really make sure it's based on evidence and try to keep it up to date. So I would tend to go with organizations like that, where they know they're not going to tell you things that aren't backed by science. So in the UK, they have the NOF, which does similar things. I believe Osteoporosis Australia would be similar. For example, the researchers that did OsteoSize and LIFTMORE, they are consultants to Osteoporosis Australia, right? So they would then help Osteoporosis Australia develop the messaging. So it's not just, you're still getting the messages from the researchers, you're just getting them through the organization, which tends to develop a patient-facing version of it.
Oh, that's fantastic. And I'm familiar with some of Osteoporosis Canada's work. I've read some of the stuff and I think it's great. I mean, I'd love to be able to, and we can transition here to kind of closing our conversation up.
Yeah.
I'm not
in a hurry, so it's okay.
Okay. Well, where can people find you, Osteoporosis Canada, some of the work? I'll link to that, those resources in the show notes.
Yeah. So you can actually just Google Too Fit to Fracture. I gave it a funny name just so that it was easy to find. Too Fit to Fracture right now is our landing page. I will say that that's based on research that was done in 2014 and 2015. So we are updating the guidelines. So there will be new information in the next year or so. I did actually do a talk for Osteoporosis Canada last week on exercise at home, talked about just fundamental movements for strength training. So again, this is not like LIFMOR program. This is just how do you get started with learning the fundamental movement that underlies a deadlift or an overhead press?
Yeah.
And how
yeah.
do you do that at home with a broomstick, right? So it's not you know, it's how to like start to learn how to move and then eventually progress that over time. And so that actually is available for replay. So you can actually go on the website and actually watch it at your leisure. It's been archived. So I can send you the link to that if you
want. Yeah. Yeah. And I'll link to that because I think that's great because especially right now, people can start getting some of these things down at home.
Yeah.
And then when they get to the point where they're progressing weight or they're ready to move up, they can go meet with somebody after things kind of settle down. And
that's right.
Yeah.
So it talks a little bit about the types of exercise that are effective and then how do you kind of get started and distill that information. Hopefully we'll have some more materials in the next year or so.
That's great. And then anybody who's interested in being one of your students, right? They could.
Like a graduate student.
Yeah.
Yeah. I usually take one or two students a year and the applications are usually sometime in January, I think. They can apply and I'm always happy to consider students. I have, I think, six right now and taking one more in the fall. So it'll be a busy, busy group, but we have some fun research to do. So I'm pretty excited about that.
That's great. Well, Laura, I really, really appreciate your time. This is a topic that we could absolutely have more credible information. And I think you're a great source for this. And I'm going to point my audience to the Osteoporosis Canon information, Too Fit to Fracture website, and any other resources that you want to share with me, I'll point them to.
Yeah. And, you know, Osteoporosis Canada is, they do have like, you can email them if you have, suggestions and things. And we're always, you know, looking for what types of questions people have. So I'm happy to take that feedback as well.
Great. Great.
And we often have, we also have, my lab has a website or an email distribution list where we send out emails about ongoing research. It might be hard for people, you know, from the US to participate in the research given the distance, but sometimes we'll also post things about, like, say, upcoming webinars and information that's being posted online. So if people want to be added to that distribution list, they can just email me directly.
Absolutely. Okay. No, that's great. That's great. Well, Laura, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
No problem.
And maybe we'll talk again here soon.
Yeah, well, happy to do, once the guidelines are out, we can revisit. How about that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, thanks again.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of the Bone Coach Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. You can find all the show notes, resources mentioned, and everything over at bonecoach.com/osteoporosis exercises, Laura Jean Gregorio. If you found this episode or any of the episodes you've listened to of the Bone Coach Podcast helpful, I'd love to hear from you. You can always leave a rating or review below, and that's going to let me know what you found most helpful, what you enjoy most, and I'll stay focused on helping bring the information and the research that's going to help you improve your bone health. I think that's it for this one. I'm your Bone Coach, Kevin Ellis. See you in the next episode.